Okay, so we are in John, and we are going to be picking up tonight in John chapter 18, verses 28 through 40 is our section. And the last couple months have really been spent around a 24-hour time period. Remember that John chapters 1 through 12 deal with the incarnation of Christ, his coming into the world, and it deals with his time of public ministry, a time in which he manifested himself as the Son of God. And he did this by means of miracles, by means of the proclamation of his message, and by the testimony of others. As a matter of fact, the Gospel of John itself is a written deposition. It is a testimony concerning the person and work and message of Christ. And we know that by the time we get to John chapter 12, Christ has been rejected by the leadership of Israel and by the majority of Israelites. And so on the night before his crucifixion, Jesus has the upper room discourse. And we read through John chapters 13 through 17. John 13, 14, 15, and 16 are all things that the Lord taught the disciples. Again, this was literally hours before the cross. And then in John 17, we see the Lord's prayer, in which he offered a prayer to the Father, quite a detailed prayer. And then in John chapter 18, we see where they leave the upper room. They go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And the section we covered last time dealt with the betrayal and arrest of Jesus Christ. And in that section, in John chapter 18, verses 1 through 27, we also saw Peter's three denials. So we had two stories going on simultaneously there. And so last time we saw where Jesus had been brought before Annas, who was the high priest, at least according to Jewish appointment. Now his son-in-law, Caiaphas, was also called the high priest, but he was high priest by Roman appointment. And so we looked briefly that at just did an overview of the trials of Christ. Remember that he had six trials that he went, that three were religious and three were civil. Three were under Jews and three were under the Romans. The three that were under the Jews were under Annas, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin. The three that were under Rome, or the civil trials, were Pilate. Then he gets sent to Herod, and then back to Pilate. And then he's finally crucified afterwards. Now I'm anticipating where we're going. But we're at this point where we're still in the trial phase. And again, these six trials all took place at night, without representation for the Lord. And it was really injustice all the way through. They really were not concerned about justice. They were concerned about having him crucified and taken to the cross. That was really their objective. And they weren't concerned with facts at all. They weren't concerned with justice at all. And we see them, in effect, railroading Christ through this ridiculous judicial system. And there's really no other way to classify it. It was just wickedness. And so tonight we pick up in John chapter 18, verse 28, and we're still in the trial phases of Christ. So picking up in John 18, 28, it says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium. And it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover." Now, we saw the religious trial in John where they found him guilty and they're bringing him now before Pilate. What John doesn't tell us is that when he was found guilty, it was ultimately for the charge of blasphemy. Now, Mark gives that to us. So go with me over to Mark chapter 14, and we'll read that section in Mark 14. And I'll read verses 55 through 64. And picking up in Mark 14, verse 55, it says, "Now the chief priests and the whole council," and notice the word council there is going to be capitalized, and that's going to be a reference to the Sanhedrin. Okay, this is the Jewish leadership, the scribes, the priests, It would be the Pharisees, the Sadducees. It would be all the religious leadership in Israel. So the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any, for many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. And some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands.' And not even in this respect was their testimony consistent." And the high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But he kept silent and did not answer. And again the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus answered, "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And there he's quoting from Daniel 7:13. The reference to the Son of Man is a reference. It's a messianic title. And they understood it. And notice verse 63, "And tearing his clothes, the high priest said, 'What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. And how does it seem to you?' And they all condemned him to be deserving of death." And so it was on this basis that he declared himself to be the Son of God that they rejected his claim and classified it as blasphemy and therefore worthy of death. So it's with this that Jesus is being brought into the praetorium to stand before Pilate. Now, realize this, that Pilate doesn't care. Pilate doesn't care about the Jewish religious system. He doesn't care about their laws, okay? So what if somebody makes themselves out to be God? It doesn't matter to him, and he's even going to speak to that issue. Now, they're going to bring that up a little bit later in John 19. But he doesn't know the basis upon which they've condemned him. And they're actually going to falsify some charges when they bring him before Pilate. So again, it says that they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. So this would still be during the nighttime, early morning hours. And it says that they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. And you scratch your head at this, because they thought much of outward ceremonial purity or cleanness. But they thought very little about the lies or the injustice or the murder, the killing of an innocent man. You talk about a double standard. I mean, the hypocrisy here is just, it's sickening. And so they bring him to Pilate into the praetorium, but they themselves are not willing to go in lest they, quote, defile themselves. You know, it makes me think of when Christ was giving the woes to the Pharisees, and he says, "You're like whitewashed tombs. You know, you're all adorned on the outside. You look beautiful and attractive, but on the inside, you're dead. You're corrupt. You're full of dead men's bones." And this is that being borne out in their behavior. And verse 29, "And therefore Pilate went out to them and said, 'What accusation do you bring against this man?'" Now it's interesting because it could be that the religious leadership thought that merely bringing him to Pilate would imply that they had tried him in their judicial system and found him guilty, and that Pilate should just salute and put him to death. But Pilate doesn't do that. Pilate comes with a question. And the question is, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" So Pilate is expecting to hear specific charges. And notice how they answered him. And they said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." Well, that's not a charge, is it?
He's going to us.
Yeah. Say what?
He's going to us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a knee-jerk response, but it's obviously not a charge.
Right.
But the implication is... we know what we're doing.
Right.
We've tried him. We found him guilty. Why are you questioning us? Why do you need specifics? Just put him to death. Just do our bidding. Now, in the end, Pilate's exactly going to do that because they're going to so pressure him The crowds and the religious leadership are going to put so much pressure upon him that eventually he's going to abandon justice and he's going to crucify Christ. He's going to have him crucified because of the pressure that's put upon him. Remember, and I mentioned it last week, and we'll talk about it again. I may mention it in future discussions. But Pilate is judicially astute. He sees the situation correctly for what it is. He sees their behavior. He knows that they delivered Christ over because of envy. He knows that their charges do not bear up under Roman law. And several times he says, "I find the man not guilty. He's not done anything worthy of death." But even though Pilate is judicially astute, he's also morally weak. And he's going to cave to the pressures of those that are bringing Christ to him to be crucified. Now, what we learn over in the Gospel of Luke is that the specific charges are named before Pilate. So go with me over to Luke chapter 23, Luke 23, verses 1 and 2. Now, these charges are made up on the spot, by the way. I mean, they had to give Pilate something. They had to try to conjure up something to give Pilate that would be a violation of Roman law. But even as Pilate hears these charges, remember that as he seeks to get information from Christ himself, Pilate again is going to walk away and find him not guilty. But the specific charges that they bring up are mentioned in Luke 23. Let me read verses 1 and 2. It says, "Then the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king.'" Well, these would all be charges that would be of concern to Rome. Now, the first two, that we found this man misleading our nation. Well, that's completely false. The other one, that he's forbidding the people to pay taxes to Caesar. He never did that. As a matter of fact, exactly, he did just the opposite, because when the question was brought to him about taxes, he said, "Bring me a coin." And they said, "Well," and then he asked the question, "Whose image is on it?" And they said, "Well, Caesar's." And he said, "Well, then render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things that are God." And so, you know, that was completely bogus too. And that he himself is Christ, a king. Now, that's going to be the one that really sticks, that Pilate's going to address. Because if you made yourself out to be a king, in effect, that you know, the way that they perceived it was that you put yourself in opposition to Caesar, because he was the king. Now when Pilate's going to have this exchange back and forth with the Pharisees, with the religious, with the leadership, he's going to say, you know, "What shall I do with your king? What shall I do with your king?" And he's going to keep bringing that up. And eventually they're going to come to the place to where they're going to say, "We have no king but Caesar." I mean, that's going to be their final reply. And they're going to keep shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." And but they're going to state where their allegiance. Really, they're just saying whatever they have to say to get Christ to the cross. But again, these are the specific charges that are brought up. So Pilate said to them, and Pilate here pushes back. He says, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." So Pilate really doesn't even want to deal with it. And then the Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." Oh, now we have the real issue, isn't it? Because they found him worthy of death. But they're not permitted. And under Roman law, they were not permitted. They could have their trials, but Rome apparently took from them the right to capital punishment. And it's interesting, because over in John chapter 19, and I know I'm anticipating a little bit, but go over to John 19 for just a second. And it was because he made himself out to be the Son of God. Now in John 19, we're going to have Pilate. He's going to have him. He's going to have him beaten. There's a crown of thorns placed upon his head. John 19:5. And then in verse 6 it says, "Now when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, 'Crucify, crucify!' And Pilate said, 'Take him for yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him.' And the Jews answered him and said, "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." You see, now that's the basis upon which they found him guilty. But again, Pilate isn't really concerned about that. Okay? But that does spook Pilate, because in verse 8 it says, "Therefore, when Pilate heard that statement, he was even more afraid." So it did kind of set him off a little bit. But you see the exchange going back and forth here. So again, the Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." And verse 32 it says, and he says, "To fulfill the word of Jesus which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die." Remember that? Because he mentioned that back in John chapter 12. John chapter 12, verses 22 and 23. Excuse me, 32 and 33. In John 12:32, it says, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was going to die. And by the way, I can't tell you the number of times I've heard verse 32 misused. "If I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." And I heard somebody say it just a week ago, because we had a discussion about it. She said, Christ said, "If I'm lifted up, I'll draw all men to myself." And so I'm trying to lift Christ up in my life so that people will be drawn to him. I said, "Well, I'm glad you're lifting up Christ in your life." I said, "But that's not really what that verse is talking about." And she kind of cocked her head. And I said, "Well, in the context, it's talking about crucifixion, being lifted up from the earth to be crucified." It was a euphemism. It was a sort of a soft way of saying something that was difficult. And we do that. We don't talk about death. We talk about, somebody passed away or they fell asleep or something, but nonetheless, in this passage here, we have where Christ specified the kind of death. Now, what was the typical way that the Jews would put somebody to death? It was stoning. But we have to keep in mind that throughout the Old Testament, Psalm 22 speaks of the crucifixion. There's another passage in Psalm 34:20, where it says, "None of my bones were broken." And this speaks of Christ. And so had he been put to death by the Jews, that would have violated that messianic passage about Christ. So again, it's important to show here that what's going on is the sovereign hand of God. That even in all of this injustice, in all of this mess that's going on, the sovereignty of God is still directing the flow of events that will eventuate in Christ going to the cross. And we always want to take that high view. We always want to step back occasionally and take that 20,000 foot view and see it from the divine perspective. Yes, ma'am.
I have a couple questions.
Yes, ma'am.
So their way of putting people to death was stoning. But they want him crucified, and that was generally like a Roman.
It was, yeah.
Style of death. And so I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, there were times in the scripture where they did pick up stones to cross, and it didn't end up happening that way.
There were previous times, yes, in John chapter 8, where they picked up stones to stone him.
Right.
You're right, and he slipped away.
Right, and I guess the crucifixion, because that's supposed to be like the most like horrific type of death, like they hated him that much, like trying to stone him wasn't enough, they wanted to crucify him.
Yeah. It could be a combination of things, and you are right that previously there was that time where they went to pick up stones to stone Christ, but he walked out of their midst. And again, that would have been a violation of the scripture concerning his death. Did they specifically want him to be crucified because it was a more excruciating form of death? There may be some that may have thought that way.
Humiliation.
Personally, I think if they would have had their druthers, mm-hmm. I think they would have done the deed themselves.
Right.
I think they would have preferred to put him to death themselves. I think they're in a place of frustration here. because they're having to, in effect, argue with Pilate. The conversation eventually is not even going to be rational. They're just going to be, it's going to be a mob. They're going to be shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." And the more he tries to reason with him, the more they, the more they shoot it down. They're really going to put the pressure on it. As a matter of fact, I sent out an email earlier. I sent it out late. I apologize. About 4 o'clock, but I sent out an email and it has all the scriptures that shows the 6 trials. Now it's about 5 pages, but if you print it out and you just read through it a few times, which is what I did earlier, so I got all this scripture sort of swimming around in my head while I'm trying to have this discussion. But when you read through it, you see the flow of the trials. But you see where it becomes more and more irrational. You see where Pilate is real. I mean, you almost, in one sense, appreciate Pilate because he's at least trying. But again, they just keep pressuring him and pressuring him and pressuring him, and finally he winds up caving into the pressure. And of course, behind all that is the sovereignty of God. We know that according to Acts 2:22 and 23, Acts 4:27, 28, those two passages which make it very clear that Christ going to the cross was according to the Father's predetermined plan. Okay. Now, it was executed both by Jews and Romans, but nonetheless, they did exactly what God intended to happen so that Christ would be led to the cross. Now, in one sense, we kind of scratch our head at that because we see the wickedness of it. And we say, well, why would God do that? But then on the other hand, we see what it results in. We see that at the cross, man does his worst, and we see at the cross, God does his best. That it's a display of his love and his righteousness. But anyway, was that it? Did you have another comment or question?
When Pilate heard the statement, he was even more afraid.
Oh yeah, John 19, yeah.
That makes me think about, like times in the scripture when people would be in the presence of the Lord, that they would come into the realization that they were in the presence of the Lord, like their nature and opposed the holiness would cause them to be afraid.
But and that could very well be, because now he doesn't know who he's dealing with. And there's this question about, wow, is this person more than human? Is he in fact God? Okay.
But his wife had warned him. Has she warned him yet?
Not yet. Not yet, but it's coming. But then the wife sends him a letter that says, have nothing to do with this righteous man, because I suffered much in last night because of a dream about him. And so there's supernatural things that are happening. And in a sense, Pilate's, He's picking up on some of this. So it goes on. It says, but to fulfill the word of Jesus, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Verse 33, therefore Pilate entered into the praetorium. Now this would be after hearing the false charges that Jesus was misleading the nation, instructing the people not to pay taxes to Rome, and calling himself a king. So Pilate enters into the praetorium with that information in his mind. And it says that he summoned Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Now when you read through those pages of scripture that I sent you, that phrase, king of the Jews, is going to appear several times. And remember that Christ is, not Christ, but Pilate's going to put that upon, he's going to put that as a superscription, not a superscription, but a plaque above the cross. And it's going to say, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews. And remember, we talked about how you see that little Latin phrase, the INRI, I-N-R-I, which stands for Jesus Nazareus Rex Judaeorum, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews. And of course, they don't like that. They're going to say, don't say that he's the King of the Jews. Say that he said. And that's his final poke at them. He's like, no, what I've written, I've written. And I think he means that it's sort of like a jab at him. But that phrase, but he asked the question, are you the king of the Jews? And remember that there were 3 charges that were leveled against him, but the one that Pilate's concerned about is that issue of a king. That's the one that sticks in Pilate's mind here. So he asked him, he said, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me? Now this is interesting here. Because the fact that Jesus is asking him questions, it's almost like Jesus is interrogating him. Okay, so now it's like, who's interrogating who? And of course, we know there will come a day when Pilate will stand before the throne of Christ. when he will stand before the great white throne, and he will be judged. And but Jesus here, he's calm, he's thoughtful, but he poses the question: are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me? And Pilate answered him, I am not a Jew, am I? It almost seems to be a little contempt there. He says, your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? Now that statement there, your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me, that speaks of the recognition that the majority, both the leadership and the people of the nation at that time, had rejected Christ. That they had rejected him. And then he says, what have you done? And of course, in Pilate's mind, he's thinking in terms of what have you done to violate Roman law, because he's serving as the governor. And Jesus answered, he said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Now, I like the way that the Net Bible translates this, because it says, my kingdom is not from this world. And you can translate it of, which is fine. I think it's a genitive of source here. But it would be from the source of this world, or from this world. In other words, it's not derived from this world. Now, he is a king, and he will have an earthly kingdom, and we're going to talk about that in our second hour. We will be very specific in that particular issue. He is a king, and he will have an earthly kingdom. But when he replies to Pilate here, he says, my kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, that is originating from this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. And of course, we know that Christ, here he talks about his servants fighting, we know that he could have very easily called down angels in his defense as well. Remember, he had said that previously. Where he said, I think he was talking to Peter, and he said, do you not know that I could call down 12 legions of angels? Well, if a legion was 6,000, then you'd have 72,000 angels called down. That's quite a large army, right? I suspect one angel would be more than enough to deal with all of them. So it's a bit of overkill, but it communicates.
Isn't he assuring Pilate that he's no threat to Caesar?
Yes, he is in effect telling Pilate, he's not denying his kingship,
right.
But at the same time, he is making clear to Pilate that he's not a threat to Rome, and again, he's dislodging the charge that was leveled against him by the Jews. And by the way, when you're reading through the Gospel of John, the majority of times when you see the term just the Jews, it really is talking narrowly about the leadership. It's not really, there are a few instances where it does refer to the nation as a whole, but by and large, when you see the term the Jews, it's actually used quite narrowly to refer to the leadership. But you're right, Cherry. I mean, in this sense, when he's replying to Pilate this way, he is in effect saying that he's not a threat. And therefore, Pilate said to him, so you are a king. And Jesus answered, you say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. And everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Now, there's a lot there. So let's look at this a little more carefully in part. So Pilate poses the question to him, so you are a king. And Jesus answered, you say correctly that I am a king. And notice the next clause that Jesus says. He says, for this I have been born. Now that speaks of his humanity. But then he says, and for this I have come into the world. Well, that speaks of his pre-existence as the Son of God. In the sense that he came into the world. I think of the passage in Isaiah where it says a child will be born, a son is given. Right? The child is born, that's his humanity. The son is given, that's his deity. Because deity is not born. But in this sense that he has come into the world. And this would be in hypostatic union, where he comes and he becomes incarnate. He takes upon himself true humanity, that God the Son adds true humanity to himself. And so an allusion again to the simultaneous natures of Christ. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world. And then he says, to testify to the truth. And I would take it to be the truth about God, about himself, about the Father. And then he makes an extremely bold statement. He says, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Now that's an extremely bold statement. And really, I believe, one that could only be made by somebody who is, in fact, the Son of God. And so when he says, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice, I take it, I made me think of John 14:6, where Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me. And so he makes this statement that everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. And then Pilate, verse 38, very popular quote, even today, Pilate said to him, what is truth? Now that question that Pilate poses to me strikes me as an admission that he did not accept Jesus or his teaching. Because if Jesus says, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice, well, if Pilate says, what is truth, then that right there tells you that Pilate doesn't see Christ for who he really is. And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him. I find no guilt in him. Now, Pilate is going to repeat this several times. And Sherry and I were talking about it earlier, because it's such a striking thing to me that he says several times, he says, I find no guilt in him, yet he keeps him under arrest. He says, I find no guilt in him, yet he's going to try to negotiate his release with either Jesus or Barabbas. He says, I find no guilt in him, but he's going to have him beaten. He says, I find no guilt in him, but he's going to have him scourged, whipped within an inch of his life. And then eventually he's going to come to the place where he says, I find no guilt in him, but he's going to turn him over to be crucified. It just doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense. But he's going to keep repeating that message. So again, that's why I say, it strikes me that Pilate is judicially astute. Again, he sees Christ as being innocent. He does not see him as guilty of the charges that are leveled against him. And yet he's morally weak because he does not stand for the sake of justice. Now, sometimes there are rulers in the world that are this way, unfortunately. We do have good rulers, and thank God for good rulers, especially when they have strong moral character. Because one can be bright, but being intelligent is not the same as having integrity or moral fortitude. And this is an example where Pilate knew the right thing to do. He knew the rightness of the situation, and yet he acted contrary to it in order to satisfy public demand. That's wrong. Yes, in the passage, I think in the passage of Romans where Paul says, to him who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. And yet, we must remember that Pilate's being there at this point is no accident. That he is there by divine design, because God knew that he would handle the situation exactly this way. And so even in Pilate's failure, God is going to succeed in securing our salvation through the substitutionary death of Christ. And we must see these together. We must hold both of these things in mind as we work through this. So he said, I find no guilt in him. And this is where Pilate is going to try to negotiate a release. He shouldn't even be doing this. But again, it's who he is. He says, but you have a custom that I release for you at the Passover, that I release someone for you at the Passover. And this would be supposedly a display of mercy. do you wish that I release for you the King of the Jews? And notice there, he's going to call him that. Do you wish that I release for you the King of the Jews? So they cried out again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. And then John tells us that Barabbas was a robber. Now the word robber here translates the Greek word lestes, and it's more than just somebody who breaks into a home when somebody's not looking and steals a few things. This would be somebody who is in effect almost like the head of an organized crime ring. I mean, the way the term is used. And of course, Mark 15:7 reveals that he was also somebody who took part in insurrection. That is, he took up arms to try to overthrow Rome. And somehow in the midst of this, he wound up participating in murder. So Barabbas is a pretty bad guy. And Pilate here, I think, cherry picks Barabbas as the worst criminal of the day, thinking that people will take Jesus over Barabbas. But again, this is going to backfire on him. But we've come to this place now where Pilate is now beginning to try to negotiate the release of Jesus. And he's going to try this a few times. He's going to try it a few times. So let's take up the summary points on this section. Yes. Yep. So the central idea of the text is that Jesus is tried before Pilate and found innocent. Yet the Jewish leadership continues to push for him to die or to be put to death. And we're getting a taste of this, and of course we'll see this developed even more as we move throughout John chapter 19. Now the Jewish leadership brought Jesus before Pilate and declared him an evildoer who deserved to be put to death. Now, that was their estimation of him. Completely wrong, but nonetheless, that was how they labeled him. The hostile Jewish leadership felt compelled to bring Jesus to Pilate because the Romans did not permit them to kill anyone through their own system of jurisprudence. Now, some commentaries I read said, well, what do you do with the stoning of Stephen? Because they picked up stones and stoned him to death. Well, they did, but that was really more of a mob act. It wasn't a judicial act. It wasn't like they had brought him on trial and gone through the system and declared him guilty and then worthy of death and executed him by way of stoning. So that's not really a comparison. But they bring him before Pilate because they realize that they did not have the right to put him to death. Now, the Jewish leadership sought religious purity by not going into the Gentile courtyard, yet their actions to lie against Jesus and seek his death revealed defiled hearts that were given over to sin. And I'll tell you, if anybody that makes me nervous is a religious person. I'll be completely honest. The people that I have had the most run-ins with in life have been religious people. Those ones, and especially if they wear the garb, oh my goodness, as soon as I see the religious clothing, I get a little nervous. My heart starts racing a little bit. Religious people just kind of put me off. And this is why, because of the way we see our Lord handled here. And you read through Acts, read through Galatians. I mean, you read the way the religious people dealt with Christians and the church, great hostility. So in one sense, they're trying to maintain this outward purity, but at the same time, they also reveal the defilement within their heart. Now, had the Jews killed Jesus by stoning, it would have resulted in broken bones, which would have contradicted biblical passages that said none of his bones would be broken. And again, Psalm 34:20 is the one that stands out. I also put in there, see also John 19, verses 36 and 37. John 19, verses 36 and 37, which points out that when the soldiers came to Christ on the cross, because they didn't want Jesus up there, and they recommended that their legs be broken, and when the soldier comes, They had broken the legs of the other two criminals that were crucified on either side of Christ. But when they came to Christ, he was already dead. And the Roman soldiers knew death. I mean, they delivered it. They knew it. And so when they pierced his side, out flowed the blood and the water, which signified that he had already died. But again, his legs were not broken. None of his bones were broken. So thus, in their sin, the Jewish leadership accomplished the will of God by turning Jesus over to the Romans that he would die by crucifixion rather than stoning. And I've got Acts in there, but let me go over there again. It's a good verse, so we'll just read them real quick. We always want to keep this plugged into our context here, because we don't ever want to lose sight of the sovereignty of God. We don't ever want to lose sight of the sovereignty of God. And we see the sinfulness of man, but we also want to see God's sovereignty. So Acts 2:22 reads, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power." But we see here again that coalescence of divine sovereignty and providence and human will. And so in one sense it shows the divine side, that he went to the cross according to the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, and yet was nailed to the cross by the hands of godless men who put him to death. And then Acts 4:27, it says, "For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate." There's our Gentiles. Okay, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. So now you've got all of humanity represented there. "To do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur." So in one sense, we see these people and these leaders behaving very, very poorly. And yet what is occurring there is exactly what God's hand and what God's purpose predestined to have happened. Now let me tell you something. That is a sovereign God. That is a sovereign God. He is in control. And he is controlling the circumstances of this life. And he is controlling the events of history. He is in control. And we must always keep that in mind, because we tend to look at political leaders, we tend to look at rulers, we tend to look at the injustices of this world, and what do we ask? Where's God? He's there. He's here. He's always in control. And I had a correspondence with a seminary student. I'm one of my students, because I, you know, do the online professor thing. And we went back and forth, and he sent me an email, and he was saying, "Well, you know, we prayed over this girl and this and this and this, and we did everything right, and she still died. And I don't understand. Where was God?" I said, "He was there. And she died at exactly the appointed time that God determined that she would die, and she's in heaven. She's a believer. Why would we want her back? In one sense, I'm sorry for your loss, but in another sense, God knows what he's doing. You know, God's not a puppet that somehow we can control him. It doesn't work that way. He's sovereign. And even as we read the injustice of these circumstances here, and we read through it and we see it for what it is, on the other hand, we must realize that exactly what is happening according to his predetermined plan and his purpose, because God is in sovereign control of the events of this life. Now, this is true not only for Christ going to the cross. And listen, it's right down to the tiniest details. I mean, John even tells us that the soldiers wouldn't even tear his robe, remember? And what'd they say? Said they cast lots for it. Right? And in Psalm 22, it was prophesied. He said, "In for my clothing they cast lots." Well, who's the they in Psalm 22? It was the Roman soldiers who were at the foot of the cross. And Proverbs 16:33 says the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. And listen, one of those soldiers threw those dice, and those dice landed exactly on the numbers that God controlled to determine those numbers. And one soldier got up and walked away with that. And that was all part of God's plan. Even down to something as innocuous to us as rolling dice was all under control. And we see the big picture right down to the finest details that God is in control of the events surrounding the cross. We must see that. We must see that. And that's why... Say what? It's no different. It's absolutely, you're right. It is still the same for today. Still the same for today. And as we begin to see how God works in history, throughout history up to that time, throughout the events of the cross and afterwards, we can take that truth and we can plug that into our own lives. And we can look at our circumstances and we can realize that God is in control. That God is in absolute complete control. Listen. The circumstances of this life are not always going to go the way you want with regard to health or finances or friendships. I mean, people will fail you. The weather will fail you. The economy will fail you. Everything will fail you. You will fail you. God will never fail you. Okay? And that is one thing you can always rely on. Absolutely always rely on. And too often we wind up getting caught in the trap of relying on people or relying on circumstances to give us a sense of self-worth, to give us a sense of purpose. Look, forget all that nonsense. I mean, it's nice to have relationships. It's nice to have friendships. It's nice to have connections with people in this world. But listen, your relationship with God is always to be paramount. And I think of the passage in Jeremiah 17:5, where it says, "Cursed is the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his strength." But verse 7 says, "Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, yea, whose trust is the Lord." And that's always where we want to be, finally. Because look, if you wind up putting too much trust in people, God will pull that rug out from underneath you. Okay? And then you'll fall flat on your back and you'll be staring straight up into the sky where you ought to be looking to begin with. So God will get your attention. He'll get you looking in the right direction. So again, even though we see the Jewish leadership accomplished, that even in their sin, the Jewish leadership accomplished the will of God by turning Jesus over to the Romans that he would be crucified rather than by stoning. And I put in here a little clause that it is generally true that hasty trials are born out of lax morals. That hasty trials, which is what we see here, isn't it? It's a rush through the trial. Okay, it's a rush to judgment. And such behavior is often born out of lax morals or poor morals. Now, Pilate would not kill Jesus on the ground of Jewish laws pertaining to blasphemy. Pilate didn't care. He didn't care about that. So the Jewish leadership had to manufacture new charges against Jesus that would have upset Rome. And that's where we saw the Luke 23, verses 1 and 2. Pilate then asked if Jesus was a king, as the Jewish leadership said. Jesus confirmed that he is a king, but that his kingdom did not originate from this world. And everyone who accepts divine truth accepts him. And that really is sort of a litmus test, isn't it? I mean, somebody can talk about Christ. I mean, there's somebody I've had several conversations with over the years, and they take the name Christian, and they'll say they believe in Jesus. But every time I have a conversation with them, they talk about all the errors in the Bible. They talk about all the things they can't trust. And I say, well, how do you even know the Jesus you believed in is true? Well, because I accept John 3:16 as truth. No. What, and the rest of it you don't? Excuse me, but you're going to pluck that out of context and say that's true? Well, how do you know? I love throwing the question. How do you know? And then, of course, that kills the conversation because they don't really want to talk about that. But there's a point where it's like, if you reject all that Christ said, even though you claim to be a Christian, haven't you really violated the very words of Christ? Where he says, those who accept the truth, in effect, accept me? Now, Pilate did not perceive Jesus as a threat to Rome and even declared him innocent. And we're going to keep seeing that brought up. Now, Pilate, and I'm speaking from the human perspective here, Pilate should have released Jesus right away. If he was truly innocent, as a just judge, he should have not succumbed to the pressure of the masses. And listen, I see some of these politicians, and my heart goes out to them sometimes, because even good politicians, you see all these people rallied around the courthouse and all these people rallied around there, and they're trying to get them to you know, act a certain way or do something a certain way against the law of the land. Listen, politicians, judges, police should abide by the law. Now, if we don't like the law, we can change the law. We can enact new law. We can repeal bad laws, enact new laws. But to try to pressure people to disobey the law, to me, is no different than what we see going on right here, in the sense that they're trying to pressure Pilate to disobey the law. And if he were, in fact, a just judge, he would, upon declaring him innocent, he should have released him. However, Pilate sacrificed justice by keeping Jesus under arrest and offering to release a known criminal, Barabbas, in his place. And the Jewish leadership rejected Pilate's offer and kept demanding that Jesus be crucified. And all the time, Jesus kept quiet. Now, we're going to see that too, because you're going to see that, in, like even in the notes I sent you, that when Jesus was being accused of these false charges, he doesn't say a thing. Now, he's willing to have this dialogue back and forth. He's willing to talk. But when when the false charges are leveled against him, he's not going to retaliate, because he knows that he's going to the cross. I mean, Christ is eyes wide open. He knows exactly what's going on. And he knows who is ultimately in control of this situation. He knows who exactly is ultimately in control of the situation.